Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Well, I know you have an interesting story, and you've had a couple different careers in your life, and we'll kind of have you take us back to kind of your early days and just a little bit of an overview of your career and some of the highlights along the way.
Well, great. Well, I grew up in northern Utah. I grew up in a large family. I have 8 brothers and sisters and a family of 9. My mother was a school teacher. My father was a soil scientist. And they took raising their children very seriously. And I'm very thankful for that. Not a day goes by that I'm not thankful for the investment that my parents made in each of their children. I can remember my father telling people that the best investment he ever made were his children. And I am very thankful every day that they took parenting seriously. I believe that the original Department of Health, Education, and Welfare are parents. And my parents took it very seriously, and I'm very thankful for that. But growing up in a small town, a rural town, Logan, Utah, northern Utah. In fact, Logan was so small when I was growing up that the entering Logan sign and the leaving Logan sign were on the same post. So it was a very small town, what I call a peek and plum town. You peek around the corner, you're plumb out of town. But I learned a lot growing up in a large family about the value of cooperation and teamwork. I developed a lot of the skills that I was going to need as an athlete, just sitting around the dinner table trying to get enough to eat, you know, in terms of quickness and agility and speed. And as you can judge from my size, I must have done okay. But I had a fascination, even at an early age, just looking around the dinner table and seeing how uniquely different each of my siblings were and trying to figure out, same parents, 9 kids, how is it possible that we are all so different? And so I've had this fascination my whole life. And as I got involved with sports, my family's a big sports family, started to see how people on sports teams and how personalities would manifest themselves and how that you couldn't always judge who was going to be the best player simply from looking at people and trying to judge them by their size or their quickness or speed or whatever. And so I have always had this fascination with what makes people tick. So grew up in a small town, went to high school there, was very involved in athletics, was a high school All-American football player, was recruited all over the country to play football, had more than 50 Division I scholarship offers, and took visits to look at Stanford and Iowa and Purdue and a number of other places. And I decided to go to school at Utah State University, which was located in my hometown. My older brother Merlin had gone to school there and had gone to be a first round NFL draft choice. And so they'd had a real history, a legacy of developing players for the NFL. And so I went to Utah State University and had a tremendous career there. I was a 2-time All-American and was an NFL first round draft choice, and went into the NFL where I played for 9 years and learned a lot about people, you know, during my collegiate career and during my NFL days. And that fascination with people continued all through that. And then after leaving the NFL, I was very involved with a number of different business opportunities. In fact, while I was playing, I tried different things every year because, not knowing what I wanted to do after my career, I thought I better get a taste for a lot of different things. And it was really, I think, very, very helpful to me to be able to do that. And so as I left professional football, I got involved in the commercial industrial real estate world, and you know, which is very similar to sports in a lot of way in terms of experiencing the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat and the competition and everything. And so I enjoyed that and did a lot of other things too. We were my brother and I were involved in the ownership of some car dealerships, and we started some companies. We bought and sold some companies, and I did some consulting for some different companies and things. But all throughout all of this, I continued to be able to start to develop an understanding for what makes people tick and what makes them ticked off. And it always seemed the responsibility of figuring out the people side of things always seemed to fall on me. And so I was able to, even, you know, back during those years that I was playing and shortly thereafter, I was the guy that was always tasked with trying to put the people together to do what needed to be done. And so that just continued to you know, whet my appetite for understanding people and what makes them individually unique. And, you know, we were using some assessment tools back then, and we'll get into that here in a little bit. But that's kind of a real 20,000 foot view of, you know, taking you from birth through my NFL career.
Yeah. Well, that's a great quick overview, but I'd love to hear a little bit with your family. And I know you're the only, I think your brother Merlin and you playing together for the Rams were the only brothers that played side by side, right, in the NFL in the history?
Yeah, in more than 100 years of professional football, the 4 years that I spent in Los Angeles with my brother Merlin, that's the only time in NFL history that brothers played side by side.
So how was that going back to the sideline? You when you were doing well, or when he was doing well, were you engaging each other on the sideline during that time?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, we were fans of each other. I mean, you know, Merle and I were brothers by birth, but we were very close friends by choice, and we spent a lot of time together, you know, off the field. Or we raised our families together. He was 8 years ahead of me. So there was a little bit of an age gap there, but he had his children a little bit later in life than we did. And so our children kind of grew up. We have two and he has three. Those five kids kind of grew up as one family. And we did a lot of traveling together. We spent a lot of time together in the summers. We both had cabins on a lake in northern Utah called Bear Lake. So we spent a lot of time together at the lake. And but you know, our lives overlapped quite a bit.
Okay. So tell me, what were some of the things that you brought forward, lessons that you learned in NFL as you were a player over that time? What were some things that you carried on in your life?
Well, there are a number of things. You know, I think that the game of football, sports in general, a lot of lessons that you learn there that are directly applicable to life and to business and to relationships. But the obvious ones being things like, you know, hard work and perseverance and learning how to deal with failure, because, you know, you don't always win and you don't always sack the quarterback. And sometimes you get blocked and sometimes you get knocked down. And, the question is, what do you do when you do get knocked down? I love there's a great quote, Vince Lombardi, the great coach of the Green Bay Packers, used to say that there's nothing wrong with getting knocked to your knees. It happens to all of us. It's what you do when you find yourself there that matters. So I learned a lot about perseverance and learned a lot about never giving up and, you know, learned a lot about always putting forth your best effort. And, you know, one of the lessons I learned from my parents growing up was the fact that, you know, that excellence should not be an option, you know, and for our family, it was not. I mean, what our parents would tell us is that what you choose to do, that's up to you, but excellence is not an option. So whatever it is that you choose to do, do it really, really well. And so that's something that I think I learned as a kid growing up, and that helped me all throughout my life, that, you know, that whatever it is that I have been involved with, I really try to be the best that I can possibly be at that. And, you know, my mother was a big stickler on autographing your work with excellence. So she would get upset when she would see somebody sign their name and you couldn't read it. And she would say, you know, if this person was really proud of who they are, they would write their name so you could read it. And she said, you know, everything you do in life you're autographing that, whether you realize it or not, your name is going on that. So why not autograph your work with excellence? So, you know, I think that that's been one of the driving forces in my life, is to try to autograph my work with excellence, to be proud of what I did, to not be willing to stop short of doing things really, really well. And I would think a lot of the success that I've had in my life has come from the practice of some of those disciplines that I learned as a kid growing up in Logan, Utah. Hmm.
So is there a defining moment that you can think back to in your football career that taught you a lasting life lesson that kind of is front of mind even today?
I think for me, it was probably some injuries that I had early in my career. I had a couple of knee injuries that could have very easily ended my NFL career. And when you get hurt like that, you immediately go from being a prospect to being a suspect. And if you can't demonstrate that you can stay on the field, that you can stay healthy, that you can play, you're not going to be in professional football very long. In fact, a lot of people kid about the fact that NFL stands for not for long. And there's probably a lot of truth to that. And a lot of people, usually the average career of players that play 1 year is 2.4 years. And of those who play 1 year, only 1 in 10 plays 5 years. Of those who play 1 year, only 1 out of 100 plays 10 years. So, wow. You know, it's not a place where you can stay very long. And you certainly won't stay there if you can't prove that you were healthy. So for me, I think it was overcoming injuries and having the confidence in myself and the perseverance to stay in a program to develop, you know, to overcome injuries, a rehab program to overcome injuries and to develop myself physically so that I could stand up to the rigors of playing the game.
Well, there must have been something in your genes to have three brothers all play in the NFL. That did you have other siblings that were in other sports? Was that?
Well, I have five sisters and three brothers. And
okay,
three of the four brothers played in the NFL. Our fourth brother was every bit as athletic as we were, but he lost one of his eyes when he was 11, and so they wouldn't let him play sports. And so that was very difficult situation for him, because he saw that the success that we were having, and I think it was hard for him to not be able to play. But you know, it is really remarkable that three of the four of us played collegiate football and played in the NFL, and it's one of the few times in NFL history that three brothers were all playing at the same time.
Huh. That's pretty remarkable. So a lot of our listeners are first-time leaders or first-time CEOs, and they're trying to figure out as far as of how to lead well. And part of that is definitely a big part of a leader's job, is putting the right people in the right spots and making people decisions. Talk a little bit about what you've learned around that. I know the people side of it and assessing talent, as well as looking at, you know, kind of how people fit in teams is part of your life's work. Talk a little bit just some of the things that you would say to a leader that's coming into a new team, either to lead an existing team or to build out a team.
Yeah, well, and that's a great question. I think that first of all, I think we have to start with definitions. And one of the things that I believe about leadership, and I like Ken Blanchard's definition of leadership, he says that leadership equals influence. So anyone who's in a position to influence other people, they are a leader. So unfortunately, you know, our culture, it likes to pick and choose who they think ought to be leaders or not. And they, I don't think they get it right. I mean, one of the things I love about the work that we do is that we have the ability to help every person understand how they would function in a leadership role, because we all do it differently. There is no one way to do leadership. You know, it's about harnessing the power, the unique power of who you are in terms of how you're going to manage other people, how you're going to lead other people. And I'm a big believer that leadership is about followership. You know, if you think you're a leader, there's a great test for that. All you have to do is stop and turn around and look behind you. If those people who were supposed to be following you, if they're not there, you're not leading. You're just out for a walk. Okay. And a lot of people in today's society, they're not leading. They're just out for a walk. You know, they think that because on their business card, it says, you know, manager or vice president or CEO or whatever it says, that they are that they're the leader. Well, positional authority is the weakest form of leadership. The strongest form of leadership is servant leadership. People will follow a servant leader because they can get further following that servant leader than they could if they were going on their own. And so I believe that leadership is about followership, and followership is about people following you, Mark, not because of who you are or what the title says on your card. I mean, they don't follow you because of the fact that your business card says that you're the leader. They follow you because of who you are, you know. And this to me is one of the biggest challenges that people have around the country, is trying to understand the uniqueness of who they are. Most people grow up not knowing who they are. They get competing bits of information. One parent tells them, you know, your dad's a doctor, you need to be a doctor. The other parent says, you know, you're pretty good on that musical instrument, maybe you should pursue a career in music. We get different bits of information from teachers and from coaches and from siblings and from friends. Most people grow up not knowing who they are. And one of the things I love about the work that I get to do using the assessment tools that we have is the fact that we get the opportunity to introduce people to themselves, many of them for the very first time. And people come to realize the uniqueness of who they are and how God created them. I mean, one of my favorite verses in scripture is 1 Peter 4:10, and it says that as each of us has received a special gift, we are to use that gift in serving one another as a display of God's manifold grace. God created each one of us uniquely different. He created us for a purpose, and a lot of people struggle trying to figure out, well, who am I, and why am I here, and what am I supposed to do? And, you know, I love the fact that we have the opportunity to introduce people to themselves and to help them figure out how to use the strengths of who they are to do what they are capable of doing.
So as a new leader, what are some things that you would say that should be priority as far as for focus? Because I think there's a lot of distractions and a lot of things that you can do. But what are the areas that you feel like leaders should be spending most of their time?
Well, in my view, it starts with self-awareness. It really starts with knowing who you are. You know, Socrates' famous quote, "Know thyself." And I, you know, I'm a big believer that if you want to be successful, not just as a leader, you want to be successful at anything, you better figure out who you are. You better figure out what it is that you do well. One of the things that I love about the work that we get a chance to do is that we have assessment tools that help a person understand the uniqueness of who they are, to help a person understand their natural talents and abilities, to help a person understand these what we call naturally reoccurring patterns of thoughts, feelings, actions, and behaviors. Naturally reoccurring patterns of thoughts, feelings, actions, and behaviors. Every person has a set. Every job has a set of those patterns that it requires from the person in the job to be able to successfully perform. And when you find a person that has the same set of patterns that the job requires and you put them into that role, they do their work as instinctively as they breathe. So this is the first piece for anybody and everybody. They need to understand the uniqueness of who they are. They need to understand the natural talents and abilities that they have. And many times people don't even realize that some of the things that they do very easily, some of the things that they love to do, they think that everybody can do that. They don't realize that that is actually a talent, a unique talent that they have that they can develop and that it can lead them to do great things. So the question about what should a leader do? Well, the first thing is trying to understand the uniqueness of who they are and their natural talents and abilities. And the second part of that is they need to understand the uniqueness of who are these people that they are working with and around, or the people that are reporting directly to them, so that they have the ability to customize the way they lead to fit the profiles of the people that they are trying to lead. Because this, you know, too many leaders only know how to lead one way. And that works with some people. It doesn't work with a lot of others. So if you want to be an effective leader out there, you better come to understand the uniqueness of who you are, and you better learn how to customize the way you lead and the way that you manage to connect with the people that you are trying to manage. So those would be two very fundamental things with regards to new leaders. There's a lot more, you know, sure. But those are two for sure.
So the whole idea around emotional intelligence and how that can impact as far as how somebody leads, what are some of your thoughts around that? What have you seen with leaders that are continuing to, again, it's knowing about where your gaps are and where you can grow and develop. Is that a part of your?
Yeah, well, that's an awareness piece. And a lot of us have blind spots, you know, that we're not good at seeing some of these things. Most of us, we like to do the things that we like to do. We like to do the things that we're good at. We don't like to do some of these other things. And, you know, one of the other things that I have learned through the work that I've done is that everybody can't do everything equally well. So, you know, we all have strengths. You know, we can talk for hours about strengths. We all have some weaknesses. But, you know, when you define weaknesses, you have to really look at weakness infers, Mark, that I can put you in the gym and we can work on that muscle. We can build it up. We can change it from a weakness to a strength. Well, there are weaknesses. We all have some, but there's a bigger category that a lot of people rarely talk about or don't even understand. And that's an area of what we call non-strengths. Non-strengths, that's a different animal. You know, my wife is 5'4" tall. She will never dunk the basketball unless they lower the rim. It doesn't matter how many books we buy her on dunking, how many dunking camps we send her to, how much time she spends in the gym, she is never going to dunk the basketball, okay? So why is it that our companies out there continue to believe that they can send somebody to a weekend seminar and they can come back, you know, doing things that they're not wired to do? Okay. Someone that's not good with numbers, guess what? They're never going to be great with numbers. They can be better than they were. We can raise the minimum threshold, but we're not going to turn somebody that doesn't have a natural aptitude for numbers. We are never going to be able to turn them into somebody who is, you know, really, really good at doing financial analysis and things like that. So we need to help people understand what are the things that fit in that strengths categories. What are the things that when you're doing them, you lose track of time. You look forward to doing them. You can't, when you have to stop doing some of those things, you can't wait to do them again. Being able to help a person tap into these areas of strength, and then being able to recognize some of these areas that are truly weaknesses that we can help them, work on those things and change them from a weakness into a strength, but to help them to isolate and understand that third category of non-strengths. And those are the kinds of things in a person's life that they need to export. If you have to do some of those things, great. You know, but people need to understand that they're never going to do everything equally well. That's just not a reality. You know, we want people doing the things that they do best. And then we want to be able to hand some of those other things off to other people who are wired to do those things. This is what healthy teams do. this is the, you know, the diversity of profiles, of the diversity of strengths and natural talents and abilities that you want on a team. And but then you have each person on that team doing the things that they do best, as opposed to expecting everybody on the team to do everything equally well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. How do you use some of the assessment tools that that you guys have developed in order to build those teams that are dynamic and, you know, everybody's kind of operating in their strengths?
Yeah, well, and it's a great question. You know, I think that maybe to start with a brief illustration that might help to get people, you know, tied into this whole concept of natural talents and abilities. So if we had Michael Jordan on this podcast with us today, we were asking him, you know, Michael, where you used to do that thing, and you know, here's, in my opinion, the greatest basketball player that ever played in the history of time. And if we were to ask him, you know, Michael, when you used to come down the court, you used to jump from the free throw line, you did three revolutions in the air, you did a double dipper backhand slam. Mark and I want to learn how to do that. Can you walk us through the steps? What was the first thing you did, and the second thing you did, and the third thing, and the fourth thing? Michael Jordan would look at us and say, what, are you nuts? You know, you can either do that or you can't. You can either do that or you can't. And that is so true. And that is, I think, a classic illustration of what it's like for a person to be functioning in their strengths. That you don't even realize what you're doing. In fact, if I were to follow you around, Mark, and watch you work, and then I were to, and if you're in a role that's a good fit for who you are, and if I were to ask you, so Mark, tell me, how do you, I've followed you around, I've watched you work, I've seen you do 27 different things with information, and how do you know how to do that? Well, you'd think for a minute, and then you'd say, I don't know, I just do it, you know, and that is true if you're a good fit for what you're doing. We call it matching talents with tasks, putting somebody into a role where those naturally reoccurring patterns that I mentioned earlier are consistent with the naturally reoccurring patterns that the job that they're in requires. And it is magic when you see it. I mean, so if we put this in sports terms, if you're John Wooden and you're coaching a national championship team at UCLA, and you've got 12 players sitting on the bench, how do you know who to put on the game? How do you know who to have out there? And because every one of them represents unique talents and abilities, right? And you know, John Wooden is I'm a big fan of John Wooden. I spent a day with John Wooden, and maybe sometime we can talk about that. But one of the things that he told me was that he said, you know, Phil, I don't think I ever had my five best players on the court at the same time. And I said, really? I said, Coach, why wouldn't you have your best players out there at the same time? And he said, because they wouldn't play well together. They wouldn't play well together. He said, every year when I would bring my team together, first day of practice, I would tell them all the same thing. If you're willing to give everything you have to the success of this team, you'll be out there on the court playing. But if your contribution is going to be all about you, then you're not going to be on the court. You're going to be sitting on the bench next to me. And, you know, that's the principle that I think helps to illustrate what leaders need to be looking to do. It's not about having just the best players doing these things. You need to figure out, who are these people? How can I put them together so that they will recognize the uniqueness of their talents and abilities, and how to contribute them to the success of the team, so that this team can be as successful as it can possibly be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That's good stuff. Tell me, as far as in your work, what do you see as, besides the self-awareness as being a blind spot for a lot of leaders, anything else that you see as kind of a reoccurring pattern with leaders as they're starting out as in those new roles?
Well, again, it's a big topic, but you know, just a few things that I think what makes sense is, again, are they in a role which enables them to use the talents and abilities they have? Okay. The question that I always like to ask when I'm talking to someone who is aspiring to be a leader is, where do you feel like you have the ability to make the greatest impact on the success of this organization? Where can you have the greatest impact? Because that's what I want to know. Because a lot of people, we can all do a lot of different things, and that's great. But I want to know, if with you, Mark, if I were bringing you into my organization, where can you have the greatest impact? What is it that you do that could have the greatest impact on the success that our company is having? Because I want you doing the things that you do best. I don't want you doing all these other things. So the question is, what is your work and what's the work of other people? Being able to, the number one problem that we deal with as we go around the country and work with clients is lack of role clarity. You know, people don't know what they're supposed to do. Organizations grow, they shrink, they get acquired, they get sold, and people's roles change. And yet the position descriptions don't keep up with those changes. And so people aren't sure of what is it that they are supposed to do. And a lot of these position descriptions are so poorly worded that you can't figure out what it says anyway. Too many of these job descriptions say something like, world peace, go achieve it. So people don't know, what the heck am I supposed to do? And, you know, I came here 4 years ago and I've been doing all these things. Our company's been, we've grown, we've been bought, we've been acquired. I don't even know if I'm supposed to still do all the stuff I was doing 4 years ago and all this new stuff. What am I supposed to do? So, you know, role clarity is the biggest problem that we deal with. And being able to match, you know, talents with tasks and is another big problem that a lot of organizations have people playing out of position. And, you know, so being able to help leaders understand how to right size their organization and how to create an organizational structure which will empower people to work from the strengths of who they are to be able to contribute to the success of the team. And you know, there's a lot of dysfunction on teams. And again, these are huge topics. We could talk for hours about them, but you know, communication is one of the biggest problems, is, you know, poor communications up and down the line. You know, this is one of the big problems that we deal with. And a lot of times with companies that have grown or companies that have been acquired or things have changed, they're going through transition. And, you know, people really struggle with going through these transitions. We get used to doing things a certain way. We like to do the things that we are comfortable doing. We like to do the things that we like to do. We like to do the things that we're good at, as opposed to doing things that need to be done. And, you know, anytime you go through transition, you know, things are going to change. And a lot of people struggle with transitions because they're holding on to the thing that they're the things that give them comfort. They know how to do things a certain way. And this is something that a lot of leaders struggle with when they get promoted in an organization. They want to continue to do the things that they used to do because they're really good at that, instead of doing the things that they're supposed to do in this new role that they've been in. And so, you know, we try to help people to understand that in transition, there are the same three phases in every transition that we all go through, and we go through hundreds of them in our lifetime. Every transition starts with an ending. Something has to end before something else can start. And before something else can start effectively, there's this piece in the middle, this wandering in the wilderness piece, where we're trying to figure out, well, what does the new chapter look like? And that you can compress the amount of time you spend in any one of those three areas, but you can't skip that wandering in the wilderness piece. You can't walk out of a room and flip the light off, walk into the next room and flip the light on, and be off to the races. Everybody has to go through those three phases of an ending, wandering in the wilderness, before they can actually have an effective beginning. So that's a big problem that you know, leaders have to deal with is the fact that their businesses are constantly in a state of transition.
Every leader is a learner and continues to develop and grow. Any books that you would put on a leader's reading list?
One of the books that we've been doing a lot of work recently is Managing Transitions. It's William Bridges. This is, I think, the best book on transitions that I've ever seen. And there are a number of really good books on servant leadership that I would put high on the list. The Blanchard Company, Ken Blanchard's got a number of books out there. One of them is Lead Like Jesus, which is really a good book. But there's a ton of books on servant leadership that I would highly recommend. That's probably something that we could have a separate conversation, and I could probably provide you with a list of a dozen books or so that would be helpful to people. But recently, you know, a lot of the, you know, we have the Gallup organization has done a lot with trying to understand strengths. You know, Marcus Buckingham's book, First Break All the Rules. I don't know if you've ever read that. It's a great book, but, you know, so I love what he has to say there. And the pretty much the summary of that book is, you know, they did a longitudinal study, more than a million employees and, you know, 400 companies, 80,000 managers. And, you know, I think it was a 50-year research project. And the summary of all of that research was simply this: people don't change that much. Don't try to put in what was left out. Try to bring out what was left in. That is difficult enough. So I'm a big believer in strengths-based leadership and, you know, helping leaders to understand what their strengths are. So, I think that, you know, the Gallup organization, that First Break All the Rules is excellent. I think that the problem is that their tools just don't work that well. Their tools are not as accurate as what I believe our tools are. Our tools are much more sophisticated and far more accurate. And in terms of helping a person understand the uniqueness of who they are and how to harness the power of who they are. Those would be a couple for sure that I think people would enjoy reading.
So outside of work, what do you do to recharge?
Well, I still train. I still play racquetball. I still lift weights and I'm still very active. I love the outdoors, do a lot of fly fishing and things like that. I've got 5 grandkids who are involved in sports. I just got back from my oldest grandson is the starting tight end at Stanford. I just got back from watching them. He's going to be a senior next year. It'll be his final season at Stanford. And so we were out for their last spring practice, which was fun. I've got my oldest granddaughter is a collegiate soccer player at Rhodes College in Tennessee. And so we watch a lot of soccer. We have a couple of other grandkids who are freshmen here at Montana State University. And so we're very involved with them. And I have a granddaughter who's a high school volleyball player and tennis player. So in Tennessee, so we spent a lot of time chasing our grandkids around. We have a summer home on a lake in Northern Utah and spend a lot of time in the boat up there out on the lake and, you know, doing a lot of camping and hiking and tromping around. So I'm very fortunate to be able to still be active and reasonably healthy. And I'm very thankful for that.
Well, how would somebody learn more about your work and what you're doing as an organization?
KnowYourStrengths.com. People can find us there. And if we can help somebody out there, we're happy to do that.
Well, thanks, Phil, and wish you continued success in all you're doing and definitely appreciate your thoughts. I know this is going to be helpful for those listening.
Great. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.